Hello, you're listening to the Scouted podcast, and I'm Tom Curran. Last month, I asked for feedback from the readers of our online magazine, and one comment read as follows. I loved your podcast, but it seems to have ended. The Geordie lad at Leeds was excellent. Is he still at Scouted? I would love a podcast return, even if it is very informal, more of a knockabout. Well, as you can probably tell, I'm not the Geordie lad at Leeds, but I'm pleased to inform you our beloved Joe Donoghue is doing extremely well in his new role at 442. Although that new role does mean he is contractually obligated not to host this podcast. Instead, I thought we'd try something else. For those who don't know, last month we announced we were moving away from the churn of constantly creating newsletters to focus on dropping slow and curated digital magazines instead, which we're calling Volumes. We dropped our first of these magazines last week. Volume 1, as we very creatively titled it, features a bunch of long-form essays and stories that we're all very proud of on all sorts of players like Jeremy Jacquet, Alex Freeman, Yann Diamandé, and it also includes a big narrative epic on a new Scouted archetype, an archetype inspired by Morgan Rogers. And the episode you're listening to now is a discussion I had with that story's author, our data scout, Jake Entwistle. It's intended as a kind of director's commentary, so you can absolutely listen to this without reading the story first. And our hope is, in fact, that you'll come out of this wanting to go and dig into the words yourself. If you're listening to this and you don't have a Scouted subscription and you don't know what a volume even is, but you'd like to go and check it out and perhaps even read the piece we're about to discuss, we've got an offer for you. You can go and unlock the entire magazine and your first month for just £2 by using the link in the show notes. And for that, you also get to download the magazine in a beautifully designed classic PDF that you can read at your own leisure and at your own pace. The link for that is in the show notes, or you can head to scoutedftbl.com/podcast. That's scoutedfootball.com/podcast. Okay, for now, here's my discussion with Jake on Morgan Rogers and his latest creation, the Berserker archetype. Enjoy. Jake, how are you today?
Well, as people can probably tell from the first podcast, we've spent an hour trying to set this up. So
we're dealing with a few environmental issues here. One being we're sat on the floor on two beanbags. The second being there's work going on next door. And the third being we're at a small risk of the washing machine being turned on at a moment's notice.
And the cat interference.
And the cat is coming in and out.
So our attempt to do cool, chilled out podcast vibes.
Well, we wanted to make it relaxed and I think we're succeeding in that. So I want to start by asking you what an archetype is. So it's clear for anyone who's like coming to this for the first time, and why you've chosen to think about football in this way, and kind of how where the inception point was. Because I think what's really interesting, and why I was so excited about this when you first pitched it to me, beyond just like Morgan Rogers being a really interesting player to think about, is that this was kind of like part of the genesis story for archetypes, right? So if you can go back to the beginning, explain what an archetype is when this project first started, and then we'll figure out where Morgan Rogers fits into the overall picture.
Yeah, I'd say I maybe wasn't thinking, well, even before I'd started writing, I remember speaking with Steve a couple of times about like, it's really cool how you can, especially with Skill Corner data, there's very clear relationships between certain metrics and certain physical attributes.
That's Steve Genovis.
Yeah.
May he rest in peace.
So that was in the mind. And then using terms like berserker, and because that, again, in this piece from 2024, it says Rogers was Aston Villa's berserker. So there was a clear concept of me trying to take a word that's more emotive than literal. So in football, with box-to-box midfielder is very literal. You know what they're going to do, but then it's usually only subscribed to a midfielder. So it was a way to try and think of these terms that capture a skill set of a player, work out where that skill set is best exhibited on the pitch for them specifically, or that player, and turn that into a word so that you could say, when you say a flyer, the fullback one I think was probably the best example, even though it came after striker one. So I was playing around with these in Monday Night Scouted, And then Skill Corner, when I pitched to do the power forward one, that was the first time it was used with actual sort of meaningful data. And that was like, everyone wants a striker that adds verticality to their team at incredible speed and repeated intensity. So that was what we noticed. Everyone that was signing a striker was 1.9 meters tall. They're all fast. No one's slow anymore. Let's boil that down into one term that you can then just consider moving forward.
I think that you can correct me, but I think there's probably three major elements to creating an archetype that I understand it, right? There's kind of the initial, almost aesthetic eye test thing, mm-hmm. right? Where you say, I'm watching Victor Gyökeres and I'm noticing the thing that defines him that he's doing most of all is running really, really fast in straight lines off the shoulder of a defender, right? Yeah. And then there's the next step where you go into how can I kind of quantify this in the data? And then the final step is kind of a semantic step where you have a look at everything you've discovered and then you figure out what's a word that's really evocative for this profile. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's all about trying to capture all of that. And I guess the most important part is that first step. It's like, what do you see? When I was getting super involved in the data and spending a lot of time looking at Skills Corner stuff, writing two pieces a month, I probably went too far the other way and started trying to name them based on the data points I was seeing. But like we said, the Rogers one was there all along. And that was born out of me just watching that and being like, wow, he's just literally rampaged through an entire midfield. And as you said, power forward was easy because we were seeing big strikers running fast at goal. Erling Haaland's been doing it for the past 6 years. So what was really nice about going back to Rogers is the whole reason we went back to the magazine was that I had started to churn things and just write descriptive things that I was seeing and getting from Excel searches and website searches. Whereas what made the power forward one successful in the sense that a lot of people have then come to us and said, oh, we'd love to talk to you about that more. I've done a couple of like podcast things. And for us, that's we're never usually asked to do that. And people I've met at conferences have
cutting that out.
Yeah. people have spoke to me at conferences now and said, we've used your like fullbacks ones to help build our profiles. So, and the fullback ones as well were based off what we were seeing. Like we know Miles Lewis-Skelly comes into midfield, dips away from pressure, sets it up.
Yeah, let's give a few examples of archetypes to kind of paint the picture of what you then did with Rogers in this piece. So the power forward was the first, and we've explained that was kind of based around Victor Gyökeres, who should explain at the time was Portuguese defenders. And then I think the fullbacks was the first time you did a...
Oh, baby, a triple.
Yeah, exactly. For the same position. So
yeah,
there's the flyer,
yeah,
there's the pathfinder, and then there is the...
It was the imposter. At the
time. Yeah. So a good way you use to like immediately key people in on these players is just to use what you call a poster boy.
Yeah.
Right? So an imposter is Miles Lewis-Skelly. It's a guy that moves into midfield at its most basic level. A flyer was Milos Kerkez,
yeah.
You know, self-descriptive again. Yeah. And a pathfinder was Trent Alexander-Arnold,
yeah.
Right? And then who are a few of the others that we've done since then?
Well, Kjell's done a few.
It's a diffuser.
So the diffuser is what Miles Lewis-Skelly has actually become. Because the imposter was because he moved into midfield and absorbed pressure, ran away from it, and then played simple passes forward. So we realized when I was looking at Hal's description of a diffuser, it was like, well, this is what Miles Lewis-Skelly does. So then do we just call him a diffuser at left back? And then you start to paint that picture of this player, because he moves into half spaces and central areas in possession, in the build-up, and escapes pressure and turns it into a positive. Why do we not call him the same name? And you can say imposter as a tag because he's playing at left back. It's not always this case, but we then realize that, again, positions don't exist now.
True.
So boiling these players down to their skill sets, and it's like when you say diffuser, you think first phase, you think central areas, half space, receiving from the centre-backs, turning away, playing passes forward. So that can be a fullback in your team, depending on what you've got. It can be a midfielder. It was Noah Nartey that was used in the sort of the Genesis article of that diffuser one, who's now ironically playing even further forward. So it's just looking at players that exhibit those particular skills in particular areas of the pitches, and then seeing how you can platform that. If you do play them at left back, what do you need to do to get them there? And then we've had developing midfielders as well, which is about running off the ball. Morgan Gibbs-White, I think, was featured heavily there.
Sven Nijpan as well,
yeah,
I think. Right?
And Nijpan was the big one that, again, Hjal's probably done 5,000 words on and why that makes sense.
Yeah. Okay, so in the piece itself, we do a lot of kind of narrative setup for this. We work our way through Rodgers' early career, through the Arsenal game that first inspired you to start thinking about in these terms. But I think because we started talking about archetypes now, we should go straight to talking about the archetype that you settled on for Rodgers. So we just spoke about those three main buckets that you use to create one of these things. So let's take them one at a time. So we start with the aesthetic. What was it that you saw on Rodgers that you felt was different enough that you felt that you wanted to come up with a term for that kind of player?
I think it's very rare now that you see such sort of destructive central carrying. I think a lot of teams that build up slowly means it gets shifted out to the wingers. It's a 1v1. It's very sort of stop-start. Jeremy Doku, for example, was excellent at dribbling and carrying the ball, but rarely does that in central areas through a lot of bodies. And he rarely does it when he receives in tight spaces. When you watch Rodgers, even if he's being played nominally on left wing, and this is again what we spoke about, like Emery's particular tactics allow him to do this from any position, but to avoid going into that bit, when you see Rodgers on the left, he will come inside and want the ball. He will want to receive the ball centrally. He doesn't receive wide and then drive inwards, which again, a lot of inverted wingers will do. Like Lamine Yamal, for example, is one of the most prolific, crazy dribblers in the world, but he still does receive it on the touchline and weave in. So Rodgers' carrying style, it's very risky and it's very unique because he receives in central areas, drives in central areas, and then his end product or what happens at the end of his berserking is either it's in the width of the goal. And that straight line angle of how he operates all within the half spaces, as in the half spaces as wide as he will go in the most perfect idea of it. That just seems something that, again, you need to be a big guy to do that. All the central midfielders are usually bigger than fullbacks now. So again, he stands out because he's a big guy. Seeing him move that gracefully and so powerfully is very eye-catching in itself. And as I said, I think it distinguishes him from wingers that dribble well. And the constant battle I've had is like carrying versus dribbling. Dribblers weave in and out of smaller spaces and take people on. Whereas Rodgers, for me, he can do that because he's a good footballer, but his best ability is to run straight at you, laugh at you as you try to tackle, doesn't really deviate the movements that much, and then leaves a trail of bodies, which is what we've constantly sort of emphasised, is you'll know where Rodgers has been because of the people that are on the floor behind him.
The pins scattering around a bowling ball.
Yeah.
And the metaphor that we keep coming back to in the piece is arrows being shot at him by an archer because of the Lord of the Rings reference. Okay, let's skip the middle section, the stat section, so I'll come back to that. Because I want to tie it in with, you began talking there about the middle of the pitch, which I think is really important to this story, right? So the term that you settled on was berserker to capture this archetype.
Yeah.
Why did that feel perfect to you?
Well, the first reason is I'm pretty sure, even though they're not like canonically in the book, the berserker from playing the Lord of the Rings like PlayStation 2 games, that is what they were called. Like the orc that the scene in from Helm's Deep where he runs and blows up the wall. That orc is different because it's bigger, it's stronger, it doesn't wear armor because it's so nonchalant about pain
They have massive swords as well.
Yeah, exactly.
As someone who is sat right now is sat next to boxes of Lord of the Rings Warhammer.
Yeah.
I can tell you the Berserker models have big swords.
Yeah.
And they were called Berserkers.
Yeah. So immediately I wanted to see if that would work. And again, there's always the awareness. It's like in the same way that people are becoming sick of tacticos, quote unquote, because there's a need to use words that aren't needed. The whole point of this for us is even if no one uses it internally, like I know what all of that encapsulates. So Berserker for me is, again, it doesn't just work because of the sort of the metaphor that we've used from the film. When you actually research Berserker, the word and the origin of that word itself, it's all about frenzy. It's all about relentless disregard for efficiency, disregard for safety. So Rogers is consistently on a spectrum of like, is he good or is he bad? Because he's very wasteful. Like that objectively, if you looked at any metric, he's not efficient in whatever he does. That's the only thing he's efficient in is shooting, in the sense that he's scoring above where he should score and all of that discussion. But he doesn't win a high percentage of his duels wherever they're recorded. His dribbling is voluminous in terms of attempts, but it's not extremely efficient in terms of, he's probably below 50% for most of the season. So Berserker is another idea to say, right, does this player have to be efficient and calculated? And yeah, efficient's the key word. And I think Berserker shows you that no matter how the thing is achieved or how many attempts it takes or how many arrows you have to take in your neck before you do it, eventually the result comes, and nothing deters you from achieving that end goal, because you've got the ability to sort of say, well, I failed, but I'm just going to do that exactly again, because I know in one situation that will work and I will blow open the entire defense.
Let's go back to this idea of efficiency versus effectiveness, because you describe it in the piece as a spectrum, right? And this idea is very central to archetypes as a whole. So can you explain how you think about that spectrum? And how it's informed archetypes before. And then we'll get a bit more specific on how it's informed this one.
Yeah, so I'm just gonna pause because I want to reference the right guy.
Pause, baby, pause.
What is it? Spielbelägerung. Right. I'm going to butcher it again, but I'll just say.
Give it your best shot, mate.
Yeah. So for me, I was thinking about it sort of subconsciously when I was developing each one. But I remember reading a piece in Spielverlegeren, which, again, I would have butchered, I think. And again, the author's name, I only have MH as the initials. And even on LinkedIn and trying to find it, they go by those initials. They wrote an article on chance conversion and just put it out really plainly that you can go about achieving better chance conversion by increasing effectiveness. So that indirectly improves the conversion rate by increasing the number of shots you have. Eventually they go in. Or you can increase efficiency, which directly improves the conversion rate, because if you only have shots that are taken from the 6-yard box, they're more likely to go in just because you're closer. And that's the basis of expected goals. So again, the key point to mention immediately is that one is not better than the other. Some people are very good at being extremely efficient, and therefore you should celebrate that. Some people are incredibly effective in a match, even if they don't score or assist from every shot or every pass. So Bruno Fernandes, for example, for me, is someone that is super effective as a footballer. But when he has a bad game, the instant reaction is to say he wastes the ball. The possession loss stat will circulate around social media. Trent Alexander-Arnold himself, again, is extremely effective, but he kicks the ball out a lot. So if that goes, if there's one game where it doesn't go right at least once, then it looks bad. So this idea is that because neither is better than the other, depending on how you play, the effectiveness efficiency spectrum is, are you good because you can just get 10 shots a match? No matter how you do it or no matter who you play against, if you generate 10 shots for your team, that is good. Or is your superpower the ability to when you have a shot, it's always in a good space. And whether that's because you're just great at moving, whether that's because of the timing of runs, whether that's because you can engineer situations through dribbling into those high quality chances, is it a case of if this guy shoots, it's going to be a goal because he's doing it from a great position? So that's the spectrum you work on. And then for Rodgers particularly, it's very obvious that he's on the effectiveness end. As I mentioned before, efficiency rates are all low, but this guy tries and tries again. And if he kicks a through ball out and no one gets on the end of it, that doesn't stop him from then trying it again as soon as he gets in the exact same position. And that's where, again, I think that concept of a berserker, which I don't want to be unfair, but that sort of ability to just erase a moment that happened previously and not let it affect your next action, I think that's something that you would then apply to these Uruk-hais that are sent in just to go berserk and just form bridgeheads and not have any regard for what's going to happen to them or the consequence of what they're going to do. They know that they're there to destroy or they're there to blow open a hole in somewhere. And Rodgers is only thinking of that rather than the failed attempts to do so.
There's a great BBC interview that we referenced a lot in this piece. Literally racing to find it right now, but I will do it from memory because I think I remember. Rodgers says something to the effect of, he's talking about foreign players and he says foreign players don't worry so much about making a mistake, right? And then he goes on to say, it doesn't matter how many times I lose the ball. I'm not in the team to keep the ball. It doesn't matter. I'm in the team to be effective. Clearly something that he understands. And you use an example in the piece to illustrate the spectrum a bit more and how the effectiveness to efficiency spectrum affects different archetypes. So obviously, if you're talking about a midfielder that you want to make 100 passes a game and protect tempo, keep the ball, you want them to be incredibly efficient, because if you're losing the ball at the base of midfield, you're in big trouble, right? And I think this brings us on to discussing the centre of the pitch, because this ties in a lot to Aston Villa's team context. And you talk about how Rodgers clearly understands he's not in the team to keep the ball, but then that then translates to the team understand that he's not in the team to keep the ball. And so what do Villa do specifically that platforms Rodgers to take these risks, and how do they set up in order to mitigate that potential risk?
So like you mentioned, he's not receiving the ball so deep that if he loses it, then a team can immediately transition and get a shot. There's risk where he loses the ball, but Villa, again, the high line, again mentioned in the piece, the high line has gone back a bit. It's not so extreme as to compare to Barcelona's, but by squeezing the pitch, they meant that when Rodgers lost the ball, the team regaining possession had such little space to work with that it wasn't then easy to generate a chance for themselves. And even if they thought it was easy, they'd be so squeezed that if you delay the pass over the top by 1 second, it's likely that your teammate would be offside. So that's the first issue, is out of possession, thinking about rest defences. And again, there are people that are much more in tune with the importance of those structures and the variance of those structures, but from a very specific example, or even just general example, is that Villa are designed that when someone loses the ball and where they expect them to lose the ball, they have usually two midfielders behind Rodgers that charge in and either make a tackle or make a foul, or are very good at recovery runs. Kamara and Onana, at their best, are two of the best midfielders at going both ways, to either press someone quickly with their long legs or recover back. The high line then makes that space even smaller. So again, if Rodgers loses the ball, there's Aston Villa teammates positioned around him to either engage the person that's picked it up or just collect the second ball itself, and then the cycle restarts.
So it's very, very aggressive counter-pressing, basically. Okay, so let's talk then a little bit about the centre of the pitch generally, because you talk a bit about a friend of the pod, John McKenzie, and his work, and how among people who think about tactics and stuff, the center of the pitch has become a bit of a hot topic. You're seeing a lot of, like, as Arsenal fans, we are well aware of the horseshoe of death, where I think it's fair to say a lot of risk-averse teams have understood that entering the box through the wings is a much less dangerous way of attempting to do so. If you lose the ball, it's further away from your goal, right?
Yeah.
So I guess I want to try and understand how each archetype is important to the modern footballing meta in some way. So how do you understand this center of the pitch conundrum, central access conundrum, and how does a player like Rodgers help to solve it?
So even when talking it through, I already can sort of spot the potential contradiction, because I've said that Rodgers doesn't keep the ball often, so there are a lot of turnovers. But then again, that means that your team has to be built to sweep up after. But the idea is that the centre of the pitch is a risky area of the pitch to try and progress from. So only the most unique and talented players have the ability to receive centrally, progress centrally, and penetrate centrally. And that's why Rodgers, at his best, is so highly regarded, is because the ability to receive, first of all, the ability to find space in between those lines requires an intelligent player. Mm-hmm. The intensity of presses, especially when they're high up, and again, you mentioned John's work, and it's specifically the hybrid pressing. So that's become really popular. Teams will jump from zonal into man marking when they spot a trigger. And again, I might be really simplifying it, but that's the idea that teams can go between one and the other. But there's a little spot when that transition happens, which John calls the space between. And again, we reference this to the Lord of the Rings because we said it's the tiny, small weakness there's only a small window to exploit it. But Rodgers being able to spot when that happens is incredibly intelligent and deserves credit in itself. But even if players have the ability to spot when that happens, or the manager has spotted them and said, oh, when our left back receives it, they're going to probably jump to press, it's one thing knowing when it's going to happen, but then being brave enough and risky enough to want the ball in that, be able to turn, and then have the physical and technical attributes to be able to carry beyond it to run away from that press that has jumped. All of that combines to create the Rodgers superpowers of the destructive ball carrying. And then, as we've said, arrows are fired at him from all directions to try and bring him down once he's received in there.
I think importantly, every time an arrow is fired, I think the way you put it in, maybe I put it, yeah, would be more accurate, is to say every arrow fired costs space, right? So any player charging out of a defensive structure to try and stop him leaves their position in said defensive structure, and then that's part of the chaos that's created, right?
Exactly. And even if they don't come out to approach him, because again, another concept that was talked about in the piece was from, and again, an account that wants to be known by Mayor Amador.
A little bit behind the scenes, yeah, here, that I thought that was their name, and then you caught, what does it mean?
It means, it's like the Portuguese version of, or Brazilian, like, as in, I know they speak, but I think it's used more in Brazil. It's their version of register.
Right, okay.
So it would be thinking if register was someone's last name.
Mr. Register.
Mr. Amador. Hit that handle, again, very timely, put out a very, again, it was one post. It was beyond, again, now Twitter, everything's beyond the word limit, but it wasn't an article, it was a post on Twitter talking about push-pull dynamics. And if you have someone that's right-footed running on the right side, then the natural intention is pushing teams back, because it's your strong side, orthodox side, and that's why you see wingers used to be out there, because it's very just natural. Whereas if you operate from your wrong side, because you cut inwards, people see you come in and look to meet you, and then there's a lot of pull dynamics. So orthodox, inverted, southpaw, however you want to visualize how people dribble. Rodgers, again, because he's in central areas, he can switch between both quite easily, because it depends where he receives the ball. But my point was that even though there's the images of players flying out to meet him, and that suggests pull because they're pulling the defenders as a last resort, what happens also as well is that they get struck by the fear of him coming towards them and just back off. You've seen is a bad example because Van Dijk's obviously in control in it and likes to do it. But Van Dijk actually never gets pulled anywhere. That's probably why he's so good, because it doesn't matter which angle you're approaching him at or whereabouts you are on the pitch. His instinct is to be pushed back because he knows he can take advantage of one miscontrol very quickly, because he's very intelligent in his reading of the ball, but also he's got some physical gifts that allow him to brush people aside himself. So for Rodgers, the idea is that yes, people will jump out and yes, people will be running from behind him to try and catch up with him. But at its core, he's actually pushing the entire opposition team back into their own box and then blowing them open apart as well with the pass or with the shot himself, which is, again, an important balance to strike for him. But the whole idea of beating that press through movement, then being able to compound the beating of the press through the carrying, then that leads to the passing and shooting at the end. And it's that particular chain combo that creates the berserker. It's picking the ball up in a risky position, having the power and the ball carrying ability to take advantage of that position, and then the frenzied approach to, we need to get a shot here, or where is the weakness? Where's the maximum amount of damage I can cause with my next action? And that mindset and that approach to a game is the berserker thing, because there will be some people that receive the ball on the half turn and then turn again and do the calmer hands, tell everyone to slow down, build it, which again is informed by team tactics. But Emery, Villa's teammates, they know that if Rodgers receives the ball, it's likely he's going to just run forward.
It's amazing how perfectly this maps onto that film sequence.
Yeah.
It's like a chicken and the egg kind of thing. It's like, how informed is this by the film sequence, or how just naturally it lines up? I think we've done this conversation kind of the opposite way to the piece is laid out, which I think is quite nice, really. I think we've done a pretty good job of getting into the weeds of the specifics of the berserker archetype. So I'd like to go back and talk a little bit more about Rodgers more generally and his career. But before I do, I just want to, maybe we could sum it all up by asking you as succinctly as possible, what is a berserker?
Okay, so for me, a berserker is a player that has destructive ball-carrying ability in central areas and is completely frenzied, is the word we use, but again, that's quite sort of emotive in itself, but is relentless in their attempts to try the most difficult thing.
Okay, so we'll keep that in mind as we now go to talk a little bit about Morgan Rodgers specifically, because this story and this archetype is obviously very much about him and ties in to his whole career to this point, which has been like curious, I suppose, is one word we could use to describe it. So his early years were a bit almost caught in the maelstrom of the English Football League loan system. So he began at West Brom, correct?
Yeah, and he was at the West Brom Academy for a long time. And I was just looking as well, and it's quite nice to mention that Jeremy Peterman is one of the, well, he's the only person to comment on it on the website. And he said, as a West Brom fan, I get furious whenever someone describes him as a City Academy player.
Yeah.
So I think it's really important to highlight that Rodgers wasn't, we've covered players, for example, Diamande, the cover star, is someone that appeared, quote unquote, out of nowhere and has gone very quick. Whereas Rodgers was part of the academy from a very young age, made his debut for West Brom at a very young age, and then that whirlwind of sort of increasing level took hold.
And you point out something quite interesting about this guy is that the two big moves in his career so far both happened when the buying club had very recently played against him.
Yeah.
So Manchester City played West Brom in the FA Youth Cup. And then they bought him, what, a couple of months later?
Yeah, 4 months. So April 2019, West Brom, Man City, FA Youth Cup semi-final. So a big game as well, knockout. And again, just to quickly, like that, Rodgers talks about himself a lot as being like a difference maker and a moments player. I think that's when the berserkers come to the fore as well, is in a knockout tie where things can get to end to end, or where things are hinging on a particular moment or the ability for someone to just once break through. I think that's where these players are really important.
Is it, and I don't know the answer to this, is this maybe a case in point where data scouting, traditional data scouting, might be a little, like, would a player like Rodgers jump off the page in traditional data scouting because his efficiency is so low?
Yeah, and that's where it depends how you look at his actions. So again, you can almost quantify relentlessness by like the percentage of touches versus whatever you want to do them to do relentlessly. And then you can also identify the like the really dangerous things. So Rodgers, rest in peace, FB ref, when I used to run those numbers, he didn't jump off the page in a lot of different ways. But then if you looked at like the percentage of his passes that were through balls, so when he makes a pass, how often is he like breaking the last line and it's going into space where someone could score, was very high, and he ranked really high for that. When you looked at like the percentage of his carrying distance, which again sounds contradictory to say that he wasn't always ranking really high for progressive distance, because again, unlike Diamande and unlike Doku, he doesn't receive it and is asked to bring the team up the pitch from wide without much challenge. When Rodgers receives it, fast forward happens, people bodies fly at him, arrows fly at him. Sometimes he doesn't scale up and the carry is short. So if you do like progressive distance per carry and distance per carry, he's good if you only look at people that go in central areas, whereas FB ref, you can't, it's hard to break, cancel out that noise. So he never looked good compared to the other wingers. So you can find it in data, but yeah, if you were doing very, if you were doing like my red bars are, he's got to complete at least half his dribbles, Rodgers wouldn't have come up. Mm. So you're losing out on players like that. And that's why, again, when you're looking for a player, it's very clear. You need to be very clear on whether you're looking for, am I looking for a player that is effective? And then, yes, when I have my pool of players, if someone has ticked all the effective boxes and they're still completing all of their dribbles at 77%, then they would deserve massive attention if it's all in central areas as well. It's not to say that you're not going to find someone that's good at it, but they need to be much lower down the priority order. So yeah, I guess Rodgers, again, unless you've got the ability to look completely at the central areas and look at the percentage of actions that are the ones that you value the most, he would come up in that way, but very sort of basic levels, you might miss him.
You'd have to be looking for it specifically, it sounds like. Yeah. And so maybe some of the broader searches that clubs are doing, he wouldn't pop up.
Yeah.
I ask only because it's quite striking, I think, this thing of like, he almost infatuates the coaches who watch him in person. So City buy him, stick him in the academy after watching him, presumably, and I don't know for sure, but presumably wreck them again when they played West Brom.
And again, this is the important point about West Brom, pretty certain lost that match. I would need to check, and it seems silly now that I don't know off the top of my head, but either way, the point about using the Arsenal game where they lost as the one where it's like, wow, look how good he is because when you see what Rodgers does well, there doesn't need to be a win at the end of it, because you know, like, if we get a guy that can do that, they may have lost this game, but we're going to win more games than we lose, because this is this is unreal. Like, I've not seen someone run through our team like that.
I mean, Yan Dumando was relegated last season. Okay, so from City, he kind of bounces around a few clubs. Lincoln City first.
Yeah. So
Lincoln City, he links up with Brennan Johnson.
Yeah.
And the two of them get them into the playoffs, which
they lost the final,
runners up. From there, it is, I do not have these notes in front of me, Blackpool or Bournemouth?
I think Bournemouth, mate. Oh yeah, too many bees running around. And again, when you've written about it so much,
this is the wonderful thing about doing a complimentary podcast for a piece. We know we were right in the article. So go and read it.
Yeah.
What do you think we're professionals over here?
It was Bournemouth next, yeah. Because again, it feels like it shouldn't be Bournemouth because of how good they are now. Yeah. But at the time, it was.
So 392 minutes across 17 appearances in Bournemouth. You see how I found the relevant information in that gap. Returns to City, one would imagine somewhat deflated. Because that was his first championship loan, right? And so that's a pretty high level for someone of his age, and we see a lot of Premier League Academy kids go down there and that kind of kickstarts their career. Didn't happen for Rodgers. Comes back,
then it's
heads out to Blackpool,
which is again in the Championship.
22 appearances for Blackpool, one goal, one assist, two yellow cards. So as many yellow cards as goal contributions. So at this point, I suppose if you were trying to do one of those straight line trajectory careers, things aren't looking super hot. And then Middlesbrough, and then a FA Cup tie.
Yeah, well, he...
Not the League Cup.
So the League Cup is where he finished top scorer of that competition. And again, it's important to note that he'd played centrally in these other loans. Rodgers has always floated between the left attacking midfield and right wing, whichever club you look at. But I think Middlesbrough is where he played the majority of his minutes centrally. Mm. And this is where, again, the wow, Rodgers is a good winger, but he's an even better attacking midfielder. And this is where you have to say, you'd think that Michael Carrick would have spotted that. Mm. And again, the way that Middlesbrough built their team, maybe they needed a particular skill set from their wingers that Rodgers didn't quite have, but playing him as this sort of secondary striker, this central attacking midfielder, because all wingers are attacking midfielders in a sense, it's just they do it from a wider position. But again, he was put into central areas, gets him within the width of the goal, can push people back with his running, can pull people towards him with that same running and get shots away. And this is where he, as I said, finished top scorer in the League Cup, so scores a lot of goals there. But also, every possible moment that Rodgers breaks through, he has the option to shoot or pass. So he's always going to be very balanced with goals and assists, because the spaces that he sees in front of him is like, I can shoot from here, but I can pass. And it's never creating a specific shooting angle that wingers do, especially inverted wingers. They're cutting in so that they can go across goal. Rodgers has always got a pretty clear choice of either. So I think in the Championship for Middlesbrough, fewer goals, but then the assists came. So the goals came in the League Cup, assists came there. Mm-hmm. The balance.
Something about Michael Carrick being the saviour of young English midfielders. Kobbie Mainoo.
Who is a diffuser.
Who is a diffuser.
Because
of course, I knew that.
If you pass to him in deep areas, he will spin away from whoever is pressing him and make them look silly. And he's done that since being reintroduced in the side.
Was Michael Carrick a diffuser?
I don't think he was as... I think he was more...
Metronomic.
Yeah, which is the platformer one. Mm. But then again, when he was younger, he used to actually get forward. Like for Spurs, he probably was developer. But his superpower of being able to control the tempo of a game, which is so alien to English players, is very platformery. Mm. Like again, that's the efficiency base, the ability to not give the ball away, but keep a tempo going with some forward passes, some sideways passes.
Very close to opening a massive tangent here about how archetypes change with the meta and Carrick played so long ago. We should not do that. An interesting quote before we get to what I consider kind of the canon event of Rodgers' career. Rodgers has been asked about this kind of tumultuous English Football League early career, and he described it as a washing machine of different styles and managers and different pressures as well, like League One playoffs to Championship to fighting relegation. And he seems to think of it as quite a positive experience, which would make sense considering where he ended up. And it all led to a moment in January 2024 when Middlesbrough met Aston Villa in the FA Cup. And Rodgers says that afterwards, Jacob Ramsey, who the two had, I believe, played with England's youth teams together and were friends through that.
Yeah, and they're both Brummy, so...
Right. Jacob Ramsey gives him a bell after the game and says, mate, Unai is in love with you. And then... by the end of that transfer window, he is an Aston Villa player. What do you remember about the kind of early, I appreciate this is off the dome, but like the very early days of Rodgers' career at Villa?
Well, again, I didn't know much about him before that. And again, this was when I would have still been at the start of 2024. So I would have still been, I wouldn't have been scouted yet, would I? Like full time?
No.
So this is
August
where,
that year.
Yeah. So this is where I was I didn't know about Rodgers before Villa because I was very much Premier League pilled. And I knew everything about everyone that was in the Premier League, but had lost a bit of touch with players coming through. So I remember being like, oh, he's top scorer, looking and being like, oh, he's top scorer of the League Cup. Obviously good. Got the Man City background again, West Brom Academy graduate, which they have a good academy themselves. So all of those looked good when you saw it. And he played on the left for the first few games. And again, I don't know whether this is me just trying to make myself look better than I was, but
that's what we're here to do.
You didn't think like he is a winger. Emery's always played narrow wingers anyway. That's what everyone talks about, is that everything central. His fullbacks are very traditional in the sense that they fly up and down. They provide the width. They provide depth with running off the ball, and then they cross it. So already Rodgers drifting inside, played a bit on the left, played a bit on the right, and then started to get his number 10 role towards the end of that season. And just the anecdote that I think I tried to add to paint that picture was, as someone that enjoys putting together a fantasy Premier League team, anyone that I join a league with expects me to win because I should know everything.
Because you're a nerd.
Yeah. And I never do. But I like being a contrarian, or at least going against the grain. So I had a little notepad and I was like, Emery clearly loves this guy. Like, they've bought him from the Championship and he's already starting. Emery is a manager that, from when he was at Arsenal, I think he was very clear in what he wanted in players. He maybe didn't always get that, but when he knows what he wants, he uses it because he said, I want that. So it was very clear that Rodgers was an Emery. It was very clear that what Jacob Ramsey would have told Rodgers about what Emery said was true, because he got put straight in the team. He'd never played in the Premier League before. He'd been bought after 6 months at Middlesbrough. He was infatuated from this performance. Again, I referenced how he wanted Zaha because Zaha did a similar thing to Arsenal at the Emirates. And he was like, I need that for my team. So he finally got his Zaha wish, but in the form of Morgan Rodgers here. And then, as I said, played on the left, looked okay, but you could see that he wanted to drift. The closer he got to the centre of the pitch, the better. Then went on the right, because then that naturally gives you that push that we were talking about, playing on his strong side, but being tucked in because Matty Cash or whoever was right back at the time would have pushed him in. And then you start to get those attacking midfield roles, even playing up front with Watkins, you could say. And then that culminates in, there's a bit of a summer. He probably gets a lot more training time with Aston Villa. They probably speak about this central role more often during the pre-season. And that's where he comes into that 24-25. Attacking midfielder pretty much every game. Destroys Arsenal without winning the game. At Villa Park, everyone now references that match as the day I noticed how good Morgan Rodgers was. But I think it was clear that Emery loved him as soon as he joined. And the fantasy footballs thing is that he would have been cheap because he was still a newbie in the league, but I put him straight in because Aston Villa are a good team, and also this guy is definitely going to play.
Under 5.5 million, I believe.
Yeah, he was 5.5.
Going back to 5.5.
Going back to 5.5, a loose, poorly executed Arctic Monkeys reference.
I want to ask you a few things that are maybe not included, well, definitely not included in the piece, which, again, will be off the dome. Number one, Thomas Tuchel's played Morgan Rodgers through... I mean, in the piece, we do reference, like, Villa sucked major ass for, like, 4 weeks at the start of this season, right? They didn't score for ages. And now they are, I think a title race would be maybe a bit generous, but clearly favourites for a Champions League place. Anyway, Tuchel persisted with Rodgers as a 10. And I know there were injury things and stuff around that, but I was wondering what you think about his role for England. And given what we've talked about how Villa plays specifically to platform his central access stuff, how do you think that translates to international football? Have you thought at all about like the efficiency to effectiveness spectrum in international football? Is that too much of a granular question?
Well, no. England's qualifying game states almost completely require a different perspective because they're so much better than the teams they face. So that's where Morgan Rodgers, his I'm going to try it mentality will again, is probably why Tuchel persisted, is because even if it's very difficult to spot gaps, or even if it's very difficult to play a pass through the lines, that doesn't stop someone of Rodgers' mindset attempting it. So again, turnovers matter even less when you've got incredible field tilt, or the opposing team would have to have their own berserker partnered with a very quick power forward to be able to really, really threaten you. And then the luxury of England is that they have Declan Rice, the horse that we mentioned at the start, the looser of arrows against Rodgers that couldn't even bring him down. And then also they've now brought in Elliot Anderson, who is a complete dynamo and covers lots of ground vertically and laterally as well. So again, they've now set Rodgers up to be like, keep trying those things. You maybe don't have as much space to do your carrying stuff, but you can still apply that berserker frenzy approach to trying to play passes into Harry Kane, trying to play passes through very small gaps and spotting weaknesses. So although you might not see the carrying as much in those qualifiers, at a tournament level, when England meet teams on their level and maybe play in a more shared game state in the sense they play more similar to Villa, then Rodgers becomes even more valuable, because not only can he exist in this low block, not only is he able to like break some low blocks down with that passing, that ambitious passing, or even the shooting that he has, he becomes even more valuable when you get to that knockout stage. And like we mentioned, managers will be wishing that he had a French grandmother that they could nationalize him, because he has the ability to destroy any midfield pairing in the world when he's at his best. So the obvious question is then, like, how does that compare to Bellingham, who is the other number 10? I know Cole Palmer's finally getting back to fitness, but they are all three different players.
Yeah.
Palmer's technique and passing and moving side to side to receive the ball and create angles for shots and passes. He generates shots through quite cerebral, calculated movements. Very clever player. Jude Bellingham, again, can carry the ball. We know he's good at that. We saw that in the Championship. We know that he can go both ways, but that season he had at Madrid and those goals he scored for England is based on movement off the ball. I think Billy Carpenter's recent piece talks about beyond and beside, and a beside is a dribbler that can engineer space. Beyond is someone that interprets space and moves without the ball. So you have three number 10s in the England team. One is someone that is ball dominant, wants to control the game himself, which is Cole Palmer, the traditional playmaker, if you like. Then you have this berserker, carrier and passer, but someone that is just frenzied attempts. And then you have Bellingham, who, again, can do some of all of those, but it's his interpretation of space beyond and around Harry Kane that will make him really stand out. So, waffling a bit to an extent, but
it's okay.
I love thinking about that England squad in particular, because you have an entire national pool to dip into, and who plays at number 10 will be incredibly tied to who plays left wing, because Gordon plus Rodgers means you have someone that goes beyond on the left in Gordon, and then you have someone that can play it there.
Yeah, the reason I asked, I guess, is something in my brain says Morgan Rodgers and tournament football just go hand in hand. And I don't know why. I can explain it. But there's just something about, like, he always has the moment in him. But
yeah, it's because you can see it now. You can be like in a tightly fought game, especially, as I said, knockout stage, clearing the ball from England are defending a corner. They clear the ball. Rodgers picks it up. There's not many players you'd want to pick it up on the edge of their box and start causing threat to the other team.
Yeah.
And there's not many players that can do that. Like, Harry Kane's not going to go up the full pitch like that. He's an incredible striker. He's going to score goals and he will be important. But if it drops to him on the edge of the box, you either hope he shoots from there and he's good enough that he can get it all the way into the net, which obviously is stupid, or he holds it and wins a foul and then we have a slow build-up. Rodgers' value is that when those moments come, when he spots the weakness in the wall, when the explosive are placed, he is the one that detonates it and blows through it. Whereas a lot of people can spot the weakness, they can't then act upon it. And that his combination is incredible. Bellingham's movement could be so good, but if you don't have someone that passes to that movement, which England have, but just as an example, a mover is only as good as the people that then find them or take advantage of the space they've created. Rodgers' beauty is that if you give him one bit of space, he can do most, 99% of it himself.
I feel like we could yap forever about how archetypes slot together like Lego pieces. I want to close this by talking to you about, I suppose this was maybe the first time that like you've done something about archetypes that hasn't been directly led by stats.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided for the magazine to kind of switch the format up a bit and do more kind of narrative, almost like cerebral, prose-led writing rather than numbers-led writing. But still, by the end of this, you've come out with The Berserker, which is a pretty robust archetype, I think. But the question then naturally becomes, who are the other berserkers? Is Rogers one of one, or can you go and find others? And so, first of all, do you have any other players on the international scene right now that you think fit this mold? And if not, how would you, and I don't want you to, you know, list 15 different metrics, but how in general would you go spotting someone who could potentially do what Rogers does?
Yeah, well, the first sort of answer is that it shouldn't be one of one, because otherwise it would be pretty redundant to have an
archetype.
It wouldn't
be a great archetype,
yeah,
would it? No.
This archetype
might as well just call it Morgs.
Yeah, you might as well just say, here's Morgan Rogers.
Yeah.
So the idea is that there are more. As I said when we were talking about like the efficiency stuff, is the important thing is like what do they do when they're in central areas? So you can look at the way to do like percentage of touches is through balls, as a really specific example and very basic. Like anyone would be able to do that with pretty, I know it's hard to get data now completely, but think of the thing that you want to happen and then how often do they try it based on how often they receive the ball. Again, you do have to consider team, but you're looking for someone that when they receive the ball, they go forward, usually in central areas. So you'd be able to, anyone that has data, if they just split the pitch up by zones, looking for the specific zone. Again, Rogers doesn't exist solely in that zone, but his most effective things are done there and he should come up there. Someone replied to the Morgan Rogers post on X when we sort of promoted it individually, and they mentioned a really good prospect, Berserker, in Tyler Dibbling.
Interesting.
Who, again, was another... Again, I realize that I just like a specific type of player. But I wrote about one of my best Monday Night Scouted pieces that, again, was picked up by the Transfer Flow and they provided us extra volume, was the idea of Tyler Dibbling being able to one-man army a team up the pitch, because he was playing for Southampton. And he was playing up front. Again, as a left-footer, sometimes you saw him on the right and you'd start seeing wingery stuff, but he's not that great at that. His standout performances against Manchester United were when he was running up the pitch and they were loosing arrows and Man United players were bouncing off him. I think he may have, in one game, got an assist or played extremely well. And anyway, on-ball volume through carrying was the metric that StatsBomb provided to help us visualize that. And my theory was like, well, does anyone have the ability to measure like how much threat they've reduced by carrying the ball up the pitch, but how much threat they've also generated by doing it? And they were like, yeah, that's what on ball volume was. And I felt a bit silly, but I was just theorizing at the time. And he was very good for that metric. So I would think that Rogers is the same. And again, Tyler Dibbling is someone that's struggling to find his feet whenever he moves clubs. Or is he a Southampton Academy graduate, went to Chelsea, went back after a year because he was homesick, got a very exciting move to Everton, probably a better level for him to go after a good debut season in the Premier League. Can't quite get in on the right wing because he's not a winger, but David Moyes wants people that are dribbly, and Ndiaye plays there, Grealish plays there on the other side. So Dibbling's main position maybe would be as the 10, but then they haven't quite found that balance.
And Keenan Dewsbury Hall,
exactly,
is
yeah,
playing very well.
So he's not quite had the platform to show those berserker tendencies, but that was a very good call. As someone that I'm trying to... So it was Ollie Shapiro on Twitter that replied.
Thank you, Ollie.
Saying that Tyler Dibbling, so many similarities, the direct carrying, the ball striking, the size, the ability to ride and bounce off challenges. Also, the words about not being afraid to lose the ball, that's something he'll need to rediscover. So Ollie's there's put an incredible sort of comparison out that saves me digging around for players. So when I was doing quick sort of data-led stuff, people like Router at Brighton, Jorginho Router at Brighton came up. And again, I can see it in the sense that he looks really frenzied when he dribbles, because he looks very unaesthetically pleasing, does it with both feet. But I quite like Router as receiving it and then turning as the last man. But that's someone else that I've been wrestling with as that might fit the same profile. But Dibbling was an incredibly good shout that Ollie deserves credit for pointing that out. So the answer is that, yes, it shouldn't be just Morgan Rogers that can do it. There are metrics that focus on the carrying and breaking through lines and bringing teams up the pitch. But then it's the frenzied approach to generating shots once you've done the carrying. So what follows the carrying is compounding the advantage that you've created.
You shall watch Tyler Dibbling with much interest. Is there anything I haven't brought up or asked you about this piece or the Berserker in general that you'd like people to understand before we get out of here?
No, I don't think so. Without saying it explicitly, I think the terms of like where it happens on the pitch, I've tried to like bring up terms like area of effect means central areas.
And point of entry as well.
And point of entry is an angle of approach. So when you're watching someone carry the ball, because again, carrying can be effective in multiple areas of the pitch, but to try and find this archetype, look for players that carry it over long distances in straight lines within the width of the goal, not someone that angles in from the touchline. And again, a winger can translate, so you can just say, well, he's playing on the wing, so he's going to do it. But the natural arc of the carry will be straight, or it will take a long, it's not jagged diagonals, it's not bursty, stop-starty dribbling, it's everything is at least on a smooth arc, if not a straight line that's going from penalty spot to penalty spot.
Did you include those, what were they, carry and pass arrow maps?
No, I've not put them in.
They're not on the web version?
No, I can add them, but yeah.
Well, I just thinking, for a big dum-dum like me, that was a really effective way of explaining what like point of entry is, because what you did, we'll have to explain it because no one's seen it, but so you compared a map of Morgan Rogers' box entries, basically, right?
Yeah.
Box entries through carrying and passing, I think they were, something like that, with Yan Diamande's. With the obvious caveat that Yan Diamande is playing on the wings.
Yeah.
But and then you illustrated, look, Rogers very often enters the box through the top of the box.
The top, yeah.
Whereas a winger enters it through the sides. Mm-hmm. And that was very useful for someone like me who needs big, bright colours and large diagrams to understand these things.
And again, the caveat of that, obviously they're in different positions, that also does include some games Rogers have played on the left. And again, that's what I want to emphasise, is that a Berserker does not have to be playing as a number 10 to do this. They can be deployed on the left, but then the team is designed to shuffle around so they still receive it in that pocket, in that central pocket. So even though he's played on the left, you can still see that slight straighter angle of approach, whereas Diamande is the diagonal from touchline to corner of the box.
Okay. Well, I think we've covered much of the story and many things that weren't in the story as well. It's the first time we've done something like this, so we have no idea if we've just talked in circles for a while. But I would encourage anyone listening to go and read the stories. I think it's a really interesting piece of football writing and thinking, of course. We were not interrupted by the washing machine, but the cat is climbing on me right now. So
there was one door exit. So
small door exit. We'll fix that in post. Yeah, so I only have one question left. Is how much pain are we both going to be in getting out of these beanbags?
Yeah, my neck has no support and I can feel it is seized up.
We're doing this in solidarity with our brother Phil Costa, who was meant to be with us today, but unfortunately has a horrendously bad trapped nerve in his back. God bless him.
So now we've trapped our own nerves.
All right, let's try and stand up.